I am Sean Tulin. I'm a professor at York University, which is not too far away. There's my email address. I'm in room 273, in case you want to come by and chat. You're always welcome to. Or if you want to email me, set up a time. Happy to chat at any point. So we're going to be discussing the Standard Model. What is it? Standard Model is basically the periodic table for particle physics. It's what particles are there and the rules for all of their interactions and properties. And of course, it's described using the language of quantum field theory. So the plan for today is just to do a real quick lightning overview of the entire Standard Model. And then over the next couple weeks, we're going to go through in more detail some subset of particular topics of importance. So we'll just start with, I'll just list all of the particles and some of their properties, just so we have a big picture view of what we're going to learn about. OK, so first I'm going to discuss the fermions. In the Standard Model, there's only spin 1/2 fermions. So we have quarks. And I'm also going to tell you something about them. I'm going to tell you what their mass is, approximately, and also their electric charge. In units of the proton charge, plus E. OK. So I'm just going to start by listing them. Well, we have up. Let's see. Down. Strange. I'm not sure which order I'm going in. Oh, already out of order. I want to group them in the following way. Charm. Top. And then I'll list their mass. This is around 2 MeV, 1.3 GeV, and 173 GeV. And for all of these, their charge is plus 2/3. Then we have down, strange, and bottom. Their masses are around 5 MeV, 95 MeV, and 4.2 GeV. And their electric charge is around minus 1/3. OK, so here are the quarks. Next, we have the leptons. So these will be the charged leptons. We have the electron, the muon, and the tau. And the mass of the electron is around 0.5 MeV. The muon is 106 MeV. And the tau is 1.8 GeV. And their charge is all minus 1. And then we have the neutrinos. Nu e, nu mu, and nu tau. Their mass is approximately 0. And their electric charge is 0. And you may know that neutrinos don't have exactly a 0 mass. So I'll just put a little asterisk here. So why don't I just tell you what the mass is? Well, we don't quite know. So let me explain what's going on. So neutrinos have a small finite mass. But the Standard Model is defined with only massless neutrinos. Okay, so for the most part, I'm going to be just putting by hand that the neutrino masses are zero. Well, why don't I put in their masses the same way I'm going to ultimately end up putting in the masses for everything else? Well, the question is, for neutrinos, there's actually two different ways we can include masses into the standard model Lagrangian. And simply put, we just don't know which one is right. So I can't write down the Lagrangian because I don't know one of two choices for how to do it. So we don't know yet which is correct. OK. So in a sense, the fact that neutrinos do have mass, you could take as evidence for physics beyond the standard model. But we could generalize the standard model to include that non-standard model physics, that neutrino mass. But we won't, because we don't know exactly how to do it. It's an open experimental question, which way is actually correct. OK. So those are the fermions. We also have bosons. So these can either have spin 0 or spin 1. So first, we'll discuss the gauge bosons. These will all be spin 1. We have the photon. So the photon, as you know, is the mediator of the electromagnetic force. And the mass, this is supposed to be mass, is 0. And the electric charge is also 0. We have the gluon. The gluon is the mediator of the strong force. It's also massless, and it also has 0 electric charge. Then we have the W bosons. And there's two of them, W plus and W minus, which are the mediators of the weak force. And their mass is 80.4 GeV. And their electric charge is just plus or minus E. Whatever I have here is plus or minus. OK, and then lastly, there's also the Z boson, which is also the weak force. And its mass is 91.2 GeV. And its electric charge is 0. OK, so these are all of the gauge bosons. And I have a gauge boson. There are gauge bosons for every force that we have. We have 3 forces in the standard model. All right. Then lastly, we have the Higgs boson. The mass is around 125 GeV, and it is also neutral. OK. So we have a bunch of gauge bosons. They mediate forces. All right, so we have 3 forces to worry about. We won't include gravity. We have the electromagnetic force. So this is mediated by the photon. And the way we set up the Lagrangian, you're familiar with quantum electrodynamics. You just introduce a photon that couples to electric charge. So for example, I could write down the Feynman rule. I have a photon. It couples to any fermion with electric charge, or any particle with electric charge. It also couples to the W's. So for example, it couples to the electron. And I can write down the Feynman rule. And And from this Feynman rule, I can compute the potential that two charged particles would feel, for example, an electron and another electron, or electron and a positron. And that's just described by the Coulomb potential. Which is, well, it depends. It can be attractive or repulsive. We have a coupling constant over R. OK. So, oops. Next, we have the strong force. Mediated by the gluon. And the gluon couples two particles that carry color. And color is really just an analogous type of charge, but for a non-abelian gauge group instead of an abelian gauge group like we had with QED. So we can think of it in the following way. We have three types of color. We have red, green, and blue. And three types of anticolor. Which you can call anti-red, R-bar, anti-green, G-bar, and anti-blue, B-bar. OK. So the idea is that quarks will carry color, antiquarks will carry anticolor. So when I have a quark field, Q, I should think of this as a Dirac field, but it also carries an additional index corresponding to its color. So because there's three types of color, I should think of it as a three-component object in color space. So I should think of it as a vector. So I could write it as the component that's red, the component that's green, and the component that's blue. Like this. And if I have an antiquark field, it also has three indices corresponding to the anticolors. Like this. All right? Now, unlike electromagnetism, in which the photon itself is neutral, electrically neutral, under its own force, the gluon, the force carrier, is not neutral. It itself carries color charge. Color. Well, actually, it's a little bit more complicated. They carry both color and anticolor. Of course, the main difference is that quarks are in the fundamental representation. Antiquarks are in the antifundamental representation. But gluons are in the adjoint representation. So they can carry both color and anticolor. So for example, I should write down different combinations, like a red and then anti-blue. Or red, anti-green, et cetera. But you might think, well, there's three colors, three anticolors. I should have nine possible gluons. That's not quite right. There's actually only eight gluons you can have. So I should say there's only eight possible combinations. And so there's 8 gluons. What happened to the 9th gluon? Well, one particular combination is actually a singlet under the symmetry. And so you would not include that one in our listing. So that one gets subtracted. So you start with 9, you subtract 1, you get 8. All right, I can also write down Feynman rules. So there's a similar vertex where gluons couple to quarks. This would be similar to what you have in QED. But because the gluon itself carries color charge, there's other types of interactions that the gluons can have. You can have a gluon that can just directly couple to other gluons. And so you can have a three-point interaction purely with glue, or you can also have a four-point interaction. OK, so these are supposed to be quarks. Up, charm, top, down, strange, bottom. OK, so this is analogous to QED. For these, there's no counterparts in QED. OK, so now you can ask, what type of potential would I have? You're familiar with the potential in QED. It's just the Coulomb potential. But it becomes slightly different due to the fact that you have these additional diagrams. So you can think of the potential between a quark and an antiquark. So when r is small, when you're at small distances, then the potential between two quarks, or a quark and antiquark, looks very similar to QED. It just looks like a Coulomb potential. So I can write it as some coupling constant. It's different, so I'll call it alpha s for the strong force over r. But then at long distances, the potential changes shape. And phenomenologically, people describe this just by a linear term. So here is something linear in r. And then I have some just extra coefficient b out in front. OK, so if I wanted to make a plot of this potential, the Coulomb potential would just look like this. But the potential here would look like Coulomb at small r, but then it would increase linearly as r gets large. OK. So the upshot is, if you want to separate a quark and an antiquark completely to infinite separation, the argument is that it takes an infinite amount of energy to do that. Therefore, we say that there are no free quarks. Since it would take an infinite amount of energy to make a free quark, to separate off one quark to infinity, they may not exist. And this feature of the strong force is known as confinement. All right. Now, this is quite a bit of an oversimplification. If you actually wanted to do the experiment and you had a quark and an antiquark together, and you gave it more and more energy, you would not actually be able to separate them out farther and farther the more energy you put in. What happens is, ultimately, it becomes energetically favorable to just produce another quark-antiquark pair from the vacuum. All right? So there's no real experiment that you can do to prove that confinement seems, you know, that this type of argument actually holds, but it just seems to be an experimental fact that we haven't been able to find a free quark so far. So So the idea of confinement is that all quarks and antiquarks must be bound into color neutral objects. These are known as hadrons. So to form a color-neutral object, there's different ways you can do it. You can have a quark-antiquark pair. So this would be like QQ bar. And so the idea is, for example, you would combine red and anti-red to make something color-neutral. Something that's color-neutral, you can say, is white. And this type of object is known as a meson. There are other types of objects you can form as well. You can form a baryon. So you have a QQQ pair, three quarks together, because there's three colors, can also form something that's color neutral, as long as you have an antisymmetric combination of the different colors. So if you have red, green and blue, this would also be equal to white, something that's color neutral. And really, it should be anti-symmetrized with respect to these three colors. Okay. There's also more complicated objects you can come up with as well. You can have two quarks and two antiquarks, for example. People are thinking about that too. But these are the simplest ones. Now, for example, you have the proton, which is UUD. The neutron is another baryon. This is UUD, UDD. And then if you want to compute the electric charge of the proton, you would just add up the total electric charges of the quarks. So you'd have two up quarks plus one down quark. And you get plus one. For the neutron, you have one up quark and two down quarks, and you would get zero. OK, so this all seems to make sense so far. So you might be worried. Well, if these quarks and antiquarks are always bound in hadrons, how do we even know they exist? If we can't see one directly and isolate it, how do we know that it's even there? We're going to discuss that in the coming lectures, probably next week. All right, so we talked about the electromagnetic force. We talked about the strong force. The only thing left is the weak force. Or you could call it the weak interaction. So just to summarize, the electromagnetic force had to do with all particles carrying electric charge. The strong force was only for quarks. It was only for the particles carrying color charge. And quarks are the only ones that do that. Also, the gluons do too. The weak force is a force for all fermions, both quarks and leptons. So all fermions couple to the weak force. And I should write down the Feynman rules. So we had different gauge bosons for the weak force. They were the W and the Z. Start with the Z. The interactions of the Z boson with fermions are very similar to QED. The Dirac structure of this matrix is a little more complicated, and we'll get into what exactly it looks like. There's also the W, and so I'll just write down the W plus. And since it's plus, I need to put an arrow. The arrow will just indicate which way charge is going. So it's giving some charge to this vertex, and so I can't have the same type of fermion on both legs. So for example, I could have a down type quark on the bottom here, charge minus a third, and then it can go to an up type quark on the top by getting that extra charge. Okay? Or I can have a neutrino going into, I'm doing this backwards. A negatively charged lepton going into a neutrino. Okay. Here, for the Z, F is a standard model fermion. And it's the same in as it is out. I just mean that the incoming state is the same as the outgoing state. So the interactions of the Z boson do not change fermions from one type or one flavor to another. Also, the strong force doesn't change fermions from one type to another. Electromagnetic force also doesn't change fermions from one type to another. But the W does. The W boson is the only interaction that can change fermions from one type to another. So it's the only thing that can change fermions from one flavor to another. The upshot is, if you can't change flavor, then all flavors would be stable, since no one flavor could decay into any other flavor. But it's because of the interactions of the W that most of the particles in the standard model are not actually stable, which is why we don't find them around today. So every standard model fermion would be stable if not for the W boson. Okay? It would make life interesting if we could have atoms that had nuclei with top quarks or bottom quarks, but that's not what we have. Okay? W boson causes things to decay. So these decays are known as weak decays. So I'll just give you some examples of weak decays. So for example, we have muon decay. Where we start with a muon, and it gets converted into its corresponding neutrino. And then we have a W. This would be a W minus. And then the W minus goes to an electron and the electron antineutrino. So this process is muon goes to electron new mu, new e bar. All right, another type of weak decay is neutron decay. So neutron decay is when a neutron decays into a proton, an electron, and an antineutrino. Neutron and nuclei, of course, are bound, they can be stable. But a free neutron will decay. And a neutron, of course, is made of three quarks. And so I should start with an up, a down, and a down. And two of the quarks will just be spectators and not participate in the weak decay. But one of the down quarks can be converted into an up quark to give us a proton. And this comes through the weak interaction. And it goes into an electron and an electron antineutrino. OK. All right, so that's kind of a summary of the entire standard model. Are there any questions so far? So far, so good. Now, our goal is to write down a Lagrangian to describe all of those particles and all of those degrees of freedom. We want to describe all known particles and all of their interactions. All known particles and interactions? Is it really all known particles and interactions? No, it's not. Sorry. We're missing some things. OK, it's not really all. OK, we're not doing some things. We're not doing dark matter, for example. There's no gravity. Dot, dot, dot. There's other physics, which we know exists. OK, we know gravity exists. There are other cosmological observations that suggest other physics beyond the standard model. That is not what we're going to try to include. Unfortunately, the standard model really only deals with the physics that we can test thus far in the laboratory. OK. So this is the goal. And we have really two guiding principles that are going to tell us how to write down this theory. So the key ingredients will be renormalizability. And gauge invariance. Why do we want these things? Well, renormalizability is somewhat important. We like renormalizable theories. We could have a non-renormalizable theory. It's still predictive, but it's only predictive up to a certain energy scale. And so there's, in a sense, a theoretical bias that we want a renormalizable theory so that we can make predictions at almost any energy scale we like. So we want a predictive theory. That's valid at high energies. And okay, why do we want gauge invariance? Well, we're going to see why in a second. It turns out it's related to the first condition, renormalizability. It turns out that some of the ingredients that we have in the standard model, for example, gauge bosons, or I should say vector bosons, that are massive, cause problems with renormalizability unless they come from a gauge theory, in which those masses are acquired through spontaneous symmetry breaking. And we're going to see how that works. But we want to start off with a theory that has a gauge invariance, or I should say, starts out with a theory that has a gauge symmetry. And we'll see how that symmetry manifests in the final interactions of the degrees of freedom. And this gauge symmetry will include both non-abelian and abelian symmetries. Okay. All right, so the next topic we'll discuss is the Higgs mechanism. And spontaneous symmetry breaking. So, it's really the weak interaction that is the problem with the standard model. Not a problem necessarily, but just a challenge. It's easy to write down the Lagrangian for QED. It's also not too much more complicated to write down the theory of quantum chromodynamics, the theory of the strong interaction. But it was the weak interaction that was really puzzling physicists for many decades. And we're going to describe what the problems are and how to resolve them through spontaneous symmetry breaking in the Higgs mechanism. So we have the W and the Z, and these are massive gauge bosons. So they have a mass, of course, but they also have what are called chiral couplings to the fermions. So they have difference couplings to left-handed and right-handed spinners. And both of these two things, it turns out, are inconsistent with gauge symmetry. And also the massive part for the gauge bosons is also inconsistent with renormalizability. Okay, so let's go through why these problems arise. So let's just start by trying to look at a simpler theory. Instead of worrying about three massive gauge bosons, we'll just worry about one. So we'll just start with a QED-like theory with a massive photon. So here's the Lagrangian. Okay. So I have the gauge kinetic part. I'm going to introduce a mass for my photon. And then I'll have a fermion. So I'll have the Dirac Lagrangian. Like so. OK, and I just have the usual definitions. So f mu nu is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And now for the covariant derivative, I'm going to write it as follows. So that's d mu. And then I have the gauge couplings. And I'm going to take my fermion here in this theory to be chiral. so that it'll have a different gauge interaction for the left and right-handed spinners. So I'll have a left-handed coupling, G left, times a left-handed projector, and then G right, times a right-handed projector. And then I have A mu. And then these projectors are just the usual thing. P right and P left are just one, plus or minus gamma 5 over 2. And then also, I should maybe tell you that G left and right are the gauge couplings. Okay, now we're going to do something very simple. We're just going to do a gauge transformation and see which terms are not gauge invariant. So we have a gauge transformation. So A mu goes to A mu plus D mu, and then I have some field alpha, not field, but function alpha of x. And then also the fermions will transform as well. So it will go to e to the minus I g left right, and then times alpha, acting on the fermion fields like this. OK, so these are the rules for gauge transformation. Now, many of the terms in the Lagrangian are gauge invariant. So f mu nu and the kinetic part of the Dirac Lagrangian are gauge invariant. But some of the terms are not. For example, the mass term for the photon is not. Okay, so that's probably pretty obvious. We just do this transformation here, and it's just a mu, plus 2 a mu, d mu alpha, plus d mu alpha squared. OK, so obviously it's not gauge invariant. We have something that depends on alpha. Also, the mass term for the spinners is also not gauge invariant. So if I have psi bar psi, this is psi left, psi right, psi bar right, psi left. And now we can just do a gauge transformation using this rule. So we have, for this first term, we have e to the i, g left minus g right, alpha, and then psi bar left, psi right. And then we have e to the minus I, g left minus g right, psi right bar, psi left. OK, so this is not equal to what we started with. It's not gauge invariant. And the reason it's not gauge invariant is because we have these chiral couplings. If g left were equal to g right, then it would be gauge invariant. OK? So that's why there was no problem in introducing a mass for the electron in QED. It's because there are no chiral couplings. The left and right-handed couplings in QED are both just E. So the mass term would be gauge invariant for QED, of course. OK, so this might not worry you. You know, we started out with this Lagrangian. Does it really need to be gauge invariant? You know, maybe I should just write it down like this and not worry so much if these vector bosons are actually gauge bosons or not. Maybe they're just vector bosons. OK, so you can't make that argument if you want the theory to actually be renormalizable. So I haven't discussed anything about renormalizability so far, but we're going to see right now what else goes wrong if we have a theory with massive vector bosons that doesn't come from a gauge theory. So, OK, what else goes wrong? So it's also not renormalizable. So to make this argument, what I want to do first is consider the propagator for just the massless photon. I just want to remind you how the calculation works, even though you probably already know. So we'll consider the Feynman propagator. This is just a reminder. For just a massless photon. So I'll write this as d, and then I need a mu and a nu, and then xy. And this is just the time-ordered product of the two photon fields. With the appropriate points and indices. OK. So when we write it down by taking a Fourier transform, in the momentum basis, we get that d mu nu of k is just minus I a to mu nu over k squared plus I epsilon. OK? So what I want to do is just very quickly go through this calculation of how you start with this and you end up getting here. The reason I'm doing it is I want to generalize it to the case of a massive photon. And so you'll see how that works. OK, so let's compute this. And we want to compute it just by plugging in a mode expansion for these fields. And then we'll take this expectation value. So we'll start with the mode expansion. So we'll just write that down for one field. I have d3k over 2 pi cubed. 1 over 2 ek. I have to sum over polarizations, I. And then I have epsilon mu I of k, so polarization vector, creation operator, e to the minus I k dot x, plus the complex conjugate of this, what I wrote before. OK, so we have this mode expansion. I could write down the same thing for a nu of y. Well, let's just plug it in and compute this expectation value. So I have d mu nu xy is the following. So I'll have an integral over k, 1 over 2 ek. Integral over some other momentum k prime. And then I'll have a sum over two polarization vectors. OK, then I have this expectation value. E to the minus I k dot x minus k prime dot y. OK. So this is what I get when I just plug in the mode expansions into this expectation value to compute this propagator. And of course, each mode expansion has two terms. And so when I plug in two mode expansions, I should have four terms. But here I've only written down one. This is the only one that's going to contribute, just because I have I need a term that has an annihilation operator acting on the vacuum, and then a creation operator acting on the vacuum, and then an annihilation operator. If I try to act on the vacuum with a different combination, let's say an annihilation operator, and then any other operator, I'll just get zero. So this is the only term that's going to contribute. And then I can recognize that when I compute this expectation value, it's just equal to 2 times ek, 2 pi cubed, delta 3 of k minus k prime. So now I can plug that in, and I should also have a delta ij. Now I can plug this in and do one of the three momentum integrals. And I'll get d3k over 2 pi cubed, 1 over 2 ek. And then I have just this sum over polarization vectors. Okay. Then you make an argument. That for a massless photon, because we only allowed certain polarizations, you can replace this term here, the sum over polarization vectors, just by the metric tensor. Okay, yeah?
Where did the exponential go?
Oh, did I forget that part? Yeah, I forgot it in my notes, but there should be some exponential. I guess it's k dot x minus y, like this. OK? All right, so I think this is all familiar, but I just wanted to redo it because the part that we need to be concerned about are the polarization vectors. That's the part that's going to change when we start talking about massive photons. Or I should say, that'll be one change. Okay, so for a massive photon, we have three polarizations. Unlike the photon, which only has two. Now, because our massive photon has a mass, we can describe those polarization vectors for the photon at rest. So when it's at rest, I can just write down what these polarization vectors are. I can choose any basis I like. So let's just choose, you know, this Cartesian choice. So this one will just be pointing in the x direction. This one will be pointing in the y direction. And this one will be pointing in the z direction. OK? So now I can compute this object here for my massive photon. So this is at rest, so I'll just put zero momentum here. complex conjugation doesn't do anything. And so I can write down what this matrix is. So it would just be 0, 1, 1, 1, like that, mu nu. OK, and then 0 is everywhere else off the diagonal. All right. So that is what I'm looking for. But I didn't want it at 0 momentum. I want it as a function of momentum k, so I'm integrating over momentum. So I just need to take this expression and boost it to an arbitrary momentum k. Here's the 4 momentum. And we're just going to do the boost along the z direction. So I need to act on this matrix with a boost matrix to call a lambda. And it's given by the following. I have gamma, 0, 0, beta gamma. 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, beta gamma, 0, 0, gamma. OK, and then beta and gamma are the usual things. Gamma is just the energy divided by the mass of this photon. And beta is just the 3 momentum divided by the energy. OK, so we started out with this object at 0 momentum. And we want to boost it. So we should compute it. So this is the thing that we want. And so we just have to act on what we had over here with our boost matrix. So that is just lambda acting on this matrix 0, 1, 1, 1. And then act with lambda on the other side. And then, OK, the whole thing, I should take the mu nu indices. All right. So I just need to multiply all of those matrices together. Here's what you get. You get k squared over ma squared, 0, 0, k times ek over ma squared, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, k ek over ma squared, 0, 0, and then ek squared over ma squared. OK, so we have this expression. And now we can write it in terms of Lorentz covariant structures. What do we have to work with? Well, the metric tensor and the 4 momentum. So this is all equal to minus eta mu nu plus k mu k nu over ma squared. So I'll just write down the final result, and then we'll be done for the day. So, when you have a massless vector boson, you replace the sum over polarization vectors by minus eta mu nu. And if you have a massive vector boson, you would replace the sum over the polarization vectors by minus eta mu nu plus k mu k nu over ma squared. Okay. So that's the main change we have to be worried about when we write down the propagator for our massive photon in our theory. So the massive vector boson propagator is, so we were trying to compute d mu nu in, well, let's write it down in momentum space. So instead of having minus I eta mu nu in the numerator, we just have minus I eta mu nu minus k mu k nu over ma squared. And then for the massless photon, we had k squared plus I epsilon in the denominator. So we still have that. But then the other thing we have to keep in mind, of course, is we have to shift the pole. Of course, the pole is no longer at zero, but it's at the mass of this photon. OK. So this is the propagator. What we're going to show tomorrow is that this extra term that you have, this k mu, k nu term that we have in the numerator, is actually going to be a big problem once we start thinking about renormalizability. It's going to introduce additional divergences into loop diagrams that we're going to have to come to grips with. OK. So that's it for today.